Welcome to Coaching Conversations, a weekly discussion of topics related to coaching and sport of volleyball at all levels. I'm your host, John Foreman, author of the CoachingVB.com blog and co-developer of the Volleyball Coaching Wizards Project. Let's dive right in. Welcome to episode 14 of the podcast. I've got Tim Alanese back with me on this one. We're going to be talking about the subject of how long should practices be? And this isn't a longer episode. We only ran about 30 minutes or so for our conversation. So overall, this will be a shorter one. But that gives me a bit more time to maybe give you an update on what's going on. As I record this introduction, it's January 10th, 2020. And it's the end of our first week of being back in the office at Madai. So not surprisingly, I suppose for anybody who's worked in the college environment, it's been pretty busy, maybe a bit more so than usual, given the fact that, you know, we're in this COVID environment and there's a lot of decisions being made and scheduling factors being decided and all that sort of stuff. So I'll try to run you through, you know, where we're at and what's going on in my coaching world here. So starting on Monday, things kind of got interesting at the very beginning, and this really doesn't even have anything to do with coaching, but it's gonna play a part in what's happening for me over the next few months. I was actually asked to take on teaching the sports marketing course here at Madai, which is, I've taken marketing. I was an undergraduate business major. I did my master's degree as an MBA, so I've taken marketing a couple times from a broad general perspective, and I've certainly done my fair share of marketing type work over the years, both in volleyball and outside of volleyball. So from a general subject matter, I've got some knowledge and experience, but I've never taught it in an academic setting. So I kind of put myself in this situation because back in the summer, shortly after I got hired, I asked the guy who runs our sports management program about the prospect of getting involved in doing some teaching, because I thought it would be, you know, a good opportunity for me to develop myself in that arena. I didn't expect it to happen this year. Honestly, I didn't necessarily want it to happen this year because I didn't yet have a grasp on what my schedule is going to be like over the course of the year. Except in, you know, broad terms, what a normal year would look like. You know, add on to that, now we've got a situation where both teams are going to be functioning heavily in the second semester, and I'll get into that in a moment. So when he asked me on Monday, you know, hey, we need somebody to cover this course, would you do it? I was like, oh, all right. Give it some thought. Ask my athletic director if it was doable, because obviously she's my direct supervisor. She had to run that up to the chain to the vice president of, I think it's student development, who is the one who oversees athletics. And had suggested that in the past, she didn't think that full-time coaches were allowed to teach. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but within 24 hours, I got the word that the VP said it was okay. I actually saw the VP on Friday. I kind of joked with her. I was half hoping that she would say no, because then I wouldn't be the bad guy if I decided to say no. But as it turns out, I mean, it's fine. I keep telling people that, you know, it's one of those whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger sort of things. I've got to do a lot of learning. I mean, the way the classes, we're talking about having the class run is, it's a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 1 hour class. So Monday and Wednesday would be in person and Friday would be online. And I've done online teaching, because I did that when I was at Midwestern State, but that course was entirely online. And it was an activity class where most of the work was the students logging their activity, their physical activity for the week. So the workouts they did, whatever. So there weren't any lectures as part of it. There were some readings and there were some discussion forum type stuff, but I wasn't lecturing to anybody either in recorded fashion or live fashion. So I'm learning a new platform in terms of, the online program aspect of things. We use Blackboard here at Midwestern. So I'm learning that, and I'm literally right now, in a course to learn how to use Blackboard, which is kind of funny, but also good because I don't know. So I need at some point I'm gonna have to sit down support very shortly with the department chair and talk about, okay, well, how does it work if you're doing 2 days in the classroom and 1 day online? And because that's not the same thing as an entirely online course, which is kind of what Blackboard is set up for. So, I'll get some insight from on it from that. I've got to go through the textbook that we use for the course, got to go through kind of the outline of the expectations of the teaching. There's supposed to be a student project involved. I'm going to be learning a lot of stuff while I'm presenting this class. Probably more than, let's be honest, probably more than the students will, just because I got to prep myself to be able to try to explain things to them and all that and present the information. So that was the start of my week. After that, things got progressively more interesting, perhaps. We got word, I think it was on Monday, that the conference has decided that we're not, I think we already got word of this, but in any case, our conference isn't hosting a women's season this year. So, and this applies to the soccer, men's and women's soccer as well, and also basketball. So the five of us, we were kind of waiting to find out what we were going to be able to do in terms of, scheduling, because there was floated the idea that, maybe we could schedule some number of non-conference matches just to get some playing in there. And they actually came out and said, yeah, we can do that. So the way they set it up is you could play up to six matches, three home, three away. And it would be over a course of an 8 week season. There's a protocol about what happens in your first week is kind of resocialization and stuff like that. But otherwise it would basically be set up as like an 8 week season. So I had a discussion with my assistant coaches, and I had a call with one of the returning players, who's probably the most experienced of the group, which is, I mean, they're sophomores. All my returners are sophomores, so I'm not saying a whole ton here about the experience, but I wanted to get her thoughts on what we should do, because our options were basically don't play and just train. So that's option one, is we just train this semester. We don't play any matches. Option two was, okay, we train and we maybe play once or twice. And then option three was, hey, let's see if we can schedule six, we'll play six. And the reason, we were talking about things in those terms is because I've got eight active players, but one of them is actually going to be learning, going to be doing things remote because she's getting surgery next month. So she's not available. So that's status six. Sorry, seven. One of the other ones is on the bowling team and is good enough to be in their starting rotation. So that potentially gets me down to only six available to play. I don't have a setter. I don't have a second middle. And one of those six players is entirely inexperienced in organized volleyball. So we basically don't have the personnel to put out a legitimately competitive team at this level. So matches were a dubious prospect. Myself, my assistant coaches, we all thought that option one of just training was probably the best way to go. And when I laid it out to the player that I mentioned I talked to, she immediately also agreed option one was the best choice. Told the athletic director that's what we're going to do. Had a meeting with the team on Zoom the next day or the day after, or maybe actually it might have even been that day, just to lay things out. I think they basically were pretty much on board. So we just basically said we're gonna take advantage of this opportunity because it's not often or basically ever that you get an off season, which is effectively what this is really, where you can train as much as we're going to be able to train. Normally in Division III, you get 16 total dates that you can do stuff on in the non-traditional season. One of those can be a match day with limitations on travel and such. And that's it. I can have no other athletic interaction with the athletes. Of course, they can work out on their own. They can do open gym stuff on their own. All that stuff's voluntary. But with only 16 dates, it's really hard to work in things like maybe you want to do a one-on-one session with a player or different players. You know, obviously, you can't. You might go 5 days a week, but that's you're only going to do that for 3 weeks. Or whereas I've got the potential to do an 8 week season, which is what I'm still going to be allowed to do with the team. So it looks like everybody's on board with that. So that's good. On the men's side, I think it was a day later, maybe 2 days later, we got word that we had heard back in first term that we're going to do a conference only schedule, but we didn't know at that stage if we were going to be allowed to do non-conference scheduling. So we got word on that this week, and that came down to okay. The schedule we've got is an 8-team round robin. We play each other once, so everybody gets 7 matches. There will be semifinals and finals for the conference tournament, so potentially, that gets teams up to 9. In order to be eligible for NCAA tournament play, you need to play 11. So we are able to play 2 non-conference matches on top of our conference schedule. So I've started working on getting those scheduled. Although we one of the things that I don't know if people just didn't think about it, didn't realize or whatever was our first conference match is actually supposed to be against a team from Ohio, which is a non-connected state to New York. That means there's a quarantine requirement for people coming in. So not a practical thing for mid-March, most likely. It's 2 months away, so things could change for sure. But it's a little bit of a questionable situation. So there's a variability there that we're going to have to deal with. And on top of that, that team might not even be able to play this year, and we may not find that out until mid-February. So we're going to have to work through some options on that. Either we skip that match or something, or go to their place, play in a neutral site somewhere in Pennsylvania, something along those lines. We'll see how that works out. But yeah, that was kind of a fun, intense sort of week. Yesterday the Buffalo Bills won their first playoff game in 26 years or something like that. So people in town are nationally very excited. We'll see how long they go. They're not my team. I'm not dissing them or anything like that. But my teams are not in it this year, so I got no problem supporting the Bills. Anyway, all right, so enough rambling for me on this one. Let's get into this discussion with Tim on how long practices should be, which is a bit rambling as well, I'll admit. But hopefully you enjoy and get some ideas and have some thoughts of your own. And I'm all open to hearing your opinion, so leave a comment, send me an email, post something on social media, whatever it is. All right, enjoy. Back in the day, practice were crazy long, and if you could do 2-a-days, you might be doing 6 or 8 hours in the gym just doing that. It's actually interesting these days. It depends on how you count stuff. There's a lot of, national teams and professional teams, they do 2-a-days. And it sounds like a lot, especially when you add it all up. But it's broken down differently than the sessions used to be in the old days where a practice used to be 3 hours. You just kind of, that was how long it went. Mm-hmm. in some cases even 4 hours. But these days, you'll have an afternoon practice, which will be kind of team, a lot of team-oriented type stuff, and you might have a morning practice, which is kind of oftentimes can be broken out into skill groups. You may have the setters going in one time, the receivers going in another time. Middle blockers might be coming in to work on blocking, and those end up tending to be shorter sessions, oftentimes combined with weightlifting or some other type of strength and conditioning type activity. So it still might be a 2.5 hour session in the morning for the athlete all combined. It's just not all in the gym on the court. Don't mean it's hard to even kind of express to people who weren't through what practices used to be like, what they are. I mean, Mark Lebedew tries to express it because he was a player in the 80s. And he's like, we would practice for 6 or 8 hours a day. And he's like, for the life of me, I can't remember what we did, except that it must have involved a lot of one person working and a lot of other people standing around, not working, waiting for their turn to work.
Oh, wasn't the biggest fan of the way things were structured, I take it.
Well, back then, he was just, I don't know if he would necessarily say he didn't think about it. He probably did think about it a bit. And I remember Karch talking about it as well from his experiences of those days also. It's like there were things that he's like, this just has nothing to do with playing volleyball. But he would still do it. And
Right.
that was just the way things were. So I think there was a lot of that. People just didn't know any better. That was just the way things ran. So everybody did it. Nowadays, people give more consideration to things like recovery and how much time you actually need to spend. And thrown in there, you could probably also say, well, you don't have 3 and 4 hour matches since we got rid of sat out scoring. Although every once in a while, I want to sneak up on you and get super long. So the conditioning element isn't the same as it used to be. But it's a, yeah, I mean, so what is the optimal length of practice?
Yeah, that's, I don't know that I have enough information personally, in terms of, what can the human body handle? What amount of recovery do we need? I think the key there is the recovery side of things. I don't know that it's necessarily in the length of the practice itself, but in what does recovery look like and how much time do the athletes have for recovery? I forgot where I was reading it, but it was one of the upper level coaches was discussing that if they need to take off, they would take practice off, not weights off, because of the importance of continuing just their strengthening, right? And I think sometimes the temptation is, oh, well, let's cancel weights but have practice. And it's like, okay, well, which one is building the body to withstand the stresses that you're putting it under? Well, that's your strength and conditioning, so you want to keep that. And if they need a break, you'd want to give up practice. For me to feel like I'm getting stuff done as a coach, I think 2.5 hours is fine. I think that gives you time to break things down, in stations, and then get a lot of team practice in there as well. You can either add film as part of that 2.5 hours, or you can add film on before that. But that's my temptation, is to say about 2.5 hours.
Going back to what you said about recovery and the length of practices being less important than the recovery time. I mean, recovery is massively important, right? At this point, if coaches don't understand that, they need to start educating themselves because it's become very, very front of mind in all of athletics. It's just if athletes who don't recover break down. They can't perform as well as they need to, and they break down, and increases injury risk and all that sort of stuff. And it actually, it's we didn't talk about it necessarily in explicit terms, but when I had David Gill on from Vert, and his talk about how you can see patterns of harder landings in players' jumps and how that increases injury risk. That's essentially accumulated fatigue. A recovered player isn't going to gradually land harder and harder and harder. You would expect them to be on a fairly even keel with their landings, assuming there's not some kind of breakdown in their mechanics. But a tired player, you're going to see that problem. And so that, you know, they use that as a big warning flag as to, hey, this kid might be getting close to doing some damage, doing their ACL or something like that. And they don't have, they don't have enough research on it to be able to say direct cause and effect, but they've got enough to say that it's certainly a potential contributory factor. So that part I'm definitely not going to push back on with you. The pushback would be, and I know people will make this case, Mark being one of them, at a certain point, attention fades. So the longer you go, the less you actually get accomplished from the perspective of they just lose focus. Now, some of that is fatigue. I mean, at the end of the day, it is partially going to be mental fatigue, partially going to be physical fatigue. So it's a question of where that point is. So when you hit that level where the athletes are having a hard time just staying locked in on what they're doing, then you're not really gaining anything by putting in more time. Certainly not from any sort of technical sort of perspective, which is why there's the tendency to put technical training more in the beginning of a session when the athletes are fresh and you're worried about more fine motor type of work than you do, you know, kind of at the end where you're thinking more team and tactics and bigger picture stuff where the athletes aren't having to think about where my arm goes or how to take this step or all these other things that really get narrowed down and require a higher degree of concentration or specific concentration anyway. So we kind of have to find that line. It's like, all right, yeah. Where can we go that, you know, we get done all the stuff that we get done. We maintain the intensity level that we want, but we're not pushing into that. Okay. They're too fatigued to really gain the benefits of any additional work.
And that's like where I came up with the 2.5 hours is obviously, I think it depends on the type of practice. So maybe in the way you described it is definitely a better way to talk about it in terms of managing the level of fatigue at which they can still maintain focus. But if you're doing, let's say you're breaking things down in the beginning and you're doing skill work and training that way, and then you're coming together and you're getting a little bit more team oriented and game focused after that, it seems to me that 2.5 hours might be a little bit long, but definitely beyond that point, I see athletes fade quickly. And I see those 3-hour practices and there's coaches that stand by that. And it seems to me that you lose them in that length of time. And like you said, it becomes unproductive towards the end. What's been your experience with those longer 3-hour type practices that you've observed?
Well, obviously a lot depends on the sort of athletes you're working with. You can never get anywhere near 3 hours with a group of 12 and unders.
Yeah.
You're lucky if you can get 90 minutes out of them. just because, and part of it is their overall level of athleticism and their conditioning to that point, just the understanding of what it takes to be an athlete, because they haven't learned what it is to be an athlete, to train. That's all part of their learning process in those early age levels. There's a whole kind of progression of how this works with athletes. You know, it's like learning to learn, learning to trade, learning to compete, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So they're in that early stage where, you know, they don't they haven't really developed the understanding of what it takes to practice for an extended period of time with the concentration and the intensity level and all that. And on top of all that, you're dealing with attention spans that are minute to begin with. So you're constantly having to shift, you know, things around just to kind of to keep them engaged the whole time and not chasing butterflies and, hey, what's going on that other court? And two of them are standing off in the corner having a chit chat about something that went on in school that day. Not that that doesn't happen with college players too, by the way, it does. if you're not keeping things flowing smoothly and productively. But yeah, I think a lot of people these days kind of look, will just kind of think in terms of a match. Hour and a half, 2 hours is a fairly typical five set or best of five sort of match time frame. So they're thinking, well, okay, that's more or less how long we have to go. And it's probably fine as a general guideline. It works. Is it optimal? Depends on what you're doing. If you have a really slow practice with not a lot of intensity, then 2 hours is probably going to drag and you're probably not going to get a lot of work done, even though you've taken up all this amount of time. Certainly there's not going to be the conditioning element to it that you think would be the whole part of, well, okay, if a match takes 2 hours, we'll practice 2 hours because then the conditioning will be roughly similar. But at the same time, you could go hard for 90 minutes and that's it. That's all you need to do. And you get all the conditioning you need, plus you get all the work done you need. From my perspective, obviously, if you're in a situation where you have very limited practices, twice a week or whatever, you got to use every single minute. You got to find a way to use every single minute. Now, maybe you can't go 100% for all those 2.5 hours or whatever you've got. You got to have to figure out, okay, I can go hard here and then we can back off there. And I got to work it so that I can keep them both physically and mentally at a reasonable level. But it would be foolish not to use those hours because you're not going to get them back anywhere else. If you're in a college environment or a professional environment where you've got more hours and you've got more flexibility, you can go 2 hours this day, 90 minutes that day, and maybe go 2.5 hours that day, or even 3 hours if you just there's more that you need to get done, or things are taking longer than you projected. As long as you're also accounting for the recovery element and working out, well, what's our load look like, and all those other considerations that go into having to plot out what a week is going to look like.
Well, and I mean, I think that brings up the recovery question too, is what are the things that we need to be doing as coaches to help with the recovery to manage these practices that we're setting up? Also, I don't know that you necessarily answered my question. Have you been around those 3 hour practices and what was your take on them?
I mean, I was in them when I was a kid. Like I was saying, they were just what you did at the time, and nobody really thought about it. I'm trying to think about the last time I've kind of been in a 3 hour practice in modern times. I'm sure I have. I just can't remember any of them. Most of them don't come in that long. 2.5 hours tends to be about as long as they go. And that's including whatever they do in the beginning, whether it's like prehab or activation or whatever you want to call it. Because by the time you get to 2.5 hours, especially with high-level athletes are pushing themselves pretty good, that's a long session. I don't think you'd want to go 3. Now, that said, you know, Mark did a presentation for AVCA where he talked about the length of his practices. And he doesn't normally go more than about 90 minutes for his planned stuff. But he also leaves on the back end, most of the time, the option for players to do stuff on their own. Maybe they want to do an extra bit of serve and pass, or maybe the middles and the setters want to work on some stuff, which is a different sort of thing. There's a benefit to it for sure. And the intensity level isn't super high because the players are kind of going at their own pace. So they're not really pushing it too hard.
Yeah, but that's I was thinking about that almost from the college perspective. What would that look like if, say, hey, we're done. Net's still up for 30 minutes. You can work on whatever you want to work on.
Yeah. I know we did it a little bit at Midwestern, but not on a regular basis. I did it when I was a fellow. Depending on the day, because sometimes we're very constrained in terms of we have a two-hour block and that's it. We got to be out. But other times we had a little bit more open-ended. So we would go through what I wanted to go through and, okay, we got some amount of time. What do you guys want to do? These kids want to work on arm swing and these are trying to work on some serving or whatever. It's like, okay, good. And I'll just kind of get involved with feedback wherever I think it's appropriate. But otherwise, let them be self-directed. Kind of goes to the whole thing that we talked about this. When we were actually, when we were doing the live stream, the autonomy.
Yes, autonomy, for sure. Trying to think what else in terms of practice link.
Obviously, there's the element of rest in the practice and how you break it up. And I know some coaches like to introduce the breaks that are very similar to breaks in matches. So sometimes it'll be like timeout length, just maybe 90 seconds or whatever it happens to be. And other times it'll be more like 3 minutes to represent between sets. Mm-hmm. So maybe you've got a 20-minute exercise and you take breaks every 10 minutes for 60 seconds. And then after the 20 or 25 minutes, you say, okay, 2 or 3 minutes, just take a break, water, chit-chat, whatever, like you would during a match. Mm-hmm. I don't go in that direction, really. I don't plot things out that way. Do I like to have breaks roughly every 20 to 25 minutes? Yeah, but I'm not thinking they need to be 3 minutes long. It's just, okay, that's about how long my activities tend to go. So it's a natural break to get water if you need it and to reset and you know, talk about what happened and set things up for the next one. So maybe they take, you know, maybe they actually take 3 minutes and I'm not really even thinking about it.
Yeah, that just flows into that from a natural state rather than an intentional or forced thing there. What about recovery? So, because you see and you hear all the time just how tired, especially college players, get at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. And so then what does recovery, does that mean making sure that they're sleeping? Because I feel like that's the number one area that the players are lacking is the self-discipline for them on their own. Maybe they do have the time and they're just not going to bed.
Right. Well, and the other thing we have to deal with is when you're talking teenagers, their sleep cycles, sleep and awake cycles tend to skew late. So they're naturally going to be inclined to stay up later. But that's hard when you've got an 8 a.m. class or a 6:30 workout or whatever the schedule happens to be.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's definitely that element to it. And as coaches, we need to be cognizant of these sorts of strains. On top of obviously the strain of just being a student and, you know, going through, you know, having to study and do reports and papers and prepare for class and all these other aspects of that are also taking up their time. Going back to something David Gill talked about, one of the things that he plots out is how many jumps should players get in practice on average over the course of a season. And unfortunately for a lot of us, there tends to be a heavy weight toward preseason, especially if you're doing two-a-days. There's naturally going to be more jumps on a day when you have two-a-days, unless you intentionally set up your structure so it, you don't have an overload like that. So you tend to see a high jump count, a high daily jump count in preseason, and then a taper off over the rest of the season. So you might be getting 120 jumps a day in preseason and then 80 jumps a day, I say in November, when you're at the end of your season, going into postseason, whatever it might be, when it probably should be the other way around. You should be starting with 80 and working your way up to the 120. And that actually ties in with something.
Is that something that he mentioned in terms of what you'd want to see?
Yeah. Yeah. He talked about it in one, if not more, of the conversations that I had with him.
So we're using up more of our athletes in the beginning of the season than what we ought to be.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We're overtaxing them. Instead of building them up through preseason and the early part of the season and working to continually get stronger and stronger as the season goes along, we're starting strong and watching them kind of slowly break down.
Well, and if you think about the mindsets, you know, the traditional mindset of two-a-days has been mm-hmm. to get these athletes in shape, right?
Yep. Get in as much work as you could possibly get in.
Right, right. Versus I like that idea of building up to it. Mm-hmm. So that is just us as coaches being mindful of the kind of drills and activities that our players are doing, especially on that jumping and landing.
Yeah.
Those counts.
Well, and it tied in with something that Kevin Hambley talked about once. I think it was on the Net Live when I first heard him talk about it, was this whole RPE, rate of perceived exertion. I've also heard it. Mm-hmm. I've heard it for the first letter being something else, but same concept. It's, you know, how hard the athletes perceive things to be in that given session. And the thing that stood out for me, I mean, there's a lot of interesting elements to it, but what really stood out to me was he talked about needing and discovering at Stanford that they needed to keep pushing things at the end of the season and keep the intensity level up and the workload up going into the NCAA tournament rather than tapering off, which is kind of the classical approach over the course of a college season and probably professional seasons and other things. Because he was actually finding that they were having more injury trouble in the old approach than they were when they were trying to more sustain a higher level of intensity. Now, obviously, no. Not every single day you'd be working things out in terms of your load on a day-to-day basis and you're plotting it over the week and how does that compare to what you did last week or whatever? But still, very different sort of mentality than what a lot of teams have done over the years.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think that probably ties into the point you made earlier about loading early and tapering off versus building up so that they can handle the load at the end.
Yeah. Well, and this is one of those things where in professional sports, you see this element more strongly than perhaps you do in college sports. For a lot of us in college, it's traditionally been the case that maybe you get in the weight room once or twice a week, and it tends to be earlier in the week because you don't want fatigue at the end of the week. You don't, you know, all that sort of stuff, and that's fair. But the idea was only kind of a maintenance sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You weren't trying to build strength,
right?
Across
your
the season.
Maintenance
you were just kind
in of, season, building yeah. strength out of season,
right? Exactly.
Approach.
Now, admittedly, the professional season is a lot longer than the college season. You know, if the European season starts in October and ends in April or something around there, give or take. But they are on a regular workout regime. That's part of what they do, and it's to continue building and to continue strengthening, and what you kind of referenced before is continuing to develop that ability to work in practice.
Right.
And, you know, Mark was probably the one that you're referring to in terms of talking about if you will, were making the choice between a ball session and a weight session, there are times you're going to pick the weight session. And actually that comes from his players in one of the teams that he coached, where if he gave them the choice, that oftentimes they would pick, well, let's hit the weight room rather than let's, you know, go on the court. Probably from, at least partly from a perspective of, we're not going to get any better in a 2-hour practice session than we already are. I mean, it's going to be very, very minor influence right on our ability to play this game coming up, but we can, you know, keep our, we're going to lose our conditioning element much more rapidly than we're going to lose our skill element.
Right.
So it's made me think a lot. And I know I had a conversation along these lines with Mick Haley back in, I think it was 2013, in his preseason with USC. And that year they were trying a new approach where they were going to work out every day after practice. Small workouts, you know, very, you know, specialized, very contained, no more than a couple of exercises. At least that was the intention. When I asked him how it went later on, he was like, yeah, it was good in theory, but our strength coach always wanted to do more than we wanted, we had in mind. So those sessions tended to be longer than in design. So I don't know if it necessarily worked out as well as he would have liked, but the idea was there.
Yeah, I wish that he was able to make that happen, because that's very interesting to me.
I've heard,
if you were to some just tap
teams
on
that are doing that a little bit more now.
And to see how that would work out for them, because that would be a very consistent thing. And especially in season, just building up. And the point you made about our season being so short is a very good one, you know, compared to a professional club season or something like that. You know, is maintenance the best method? I don't know. Should we be trying to build during season? With as short as the season is, it seems like the answer to that question is no. But then you get break, and then you have spring, which isn't necessarily super long anyways, and then you're counting on your athletes and doing their own thing in the summer. So when do you build?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. That's part of the problem is, okay, the only period that you end up having like a sustained focus on developing strength and speed and power and all that sort of stuff is your off season. It's, you know, for women's volleyball from call it February to April. So 3 months.
Right.
Approximately. So then you've got 3 months of summer. You've got maybe 2 months between semesters.
Honestly, I'm just happy if they come close to maintaining in the summer.
Yeah. Don't come to preseason hurt. That's first priority.
So it's like, well, could you then build in the fall also? And if so, how much on-court performance would you be giving up to build? Or would you be giving up on-court performance at all?
Exactly.
What would the results be? Could you balance it to where maybe early on it's affecting them, but by the end of the, you know, end of conference, you really built up to an optimal level to where they're performing better.
And the question then becomes, because obviously there's a time factor when you're talking NCAAs, you've only got 20 hours a week. Are coaches willing to give up an extra hour of ball, hour or two of ball training to spend that much more time in the weight room? And you can make the case that it's probably a good trade-off for exactly what we just talked about. Their ball skills are not going to slip because they didn't practice for 2 hours.
Right.
There's extra 2 hours in the weight room might provide, if nothing else, sustaining ability and maybe help to build for down the line, make some incremental gains.
I agree.
Wow, that spun off in a very different direction than it kind of started off and did it.
Well, but I think it's part of the conversation though that needs to be talked about.
Yeah.
Especially if you're talking practice planning and obviously your level matters, right? Whether you're coaching club players or whether you're coaching high school athletes, there's all kinds of individual considerations there, but
Yeah, I mean, if I'm coaching club kids and I'm only seeing them a couple times a week, I'm not giving up court time.
Right.
I mean, unless I have massive amounts of
No,
it.
not.
I mean, if I've got a 3-hour session and I want to take 45 minutes to work on strength and conditioning, okay, that's probably reasonable. But if you've got
Wait.
two 90-minute sessions, nope.
I had a similar discussion with a club down in the DC area, and they were working with younger athletes, and they were doing a bunch of functional movement, right? So
Sure.
not volleyball, like 30 minutes of just functional movement. And we had that conversation. I think they were curious as to what my take on that was. And I was like, look, if you have them, as long as you get enough volleyball time in, then I'm all for adding in 30 minutes of functional movement. If you only had them twice a week and you only had them for an hour and a half, I don't know how much functional movement I do versus volleyball. But it was a situation where they had these kids actually come in 30 minutes before their scheduled court time with a net and do it, in the weight room area. And I'm like, that's ideal because it's not like you're giving up your time with the net. So.
So coaches that want to insert conditioning elements into their practices, first off, I don't think you need it. If you run practices at an appropriate level of intensity, then you're going to get plenty of conditioning just in that alone. So you're just that time that could be better used otherwise. And at the same point, if you're only going a couple times a week and maybe you're getting in 30 minutes worth of S&C, that's probably not having a very big impact. They realistically, in order to build muscle, to build strength, they're going to need more than two 30-minute sessions, most likely, depending on where they are in their development. So if you really want them to do it, then find a way for them to do it outside of the gym sessions and make that part of your program. It's just a different aspect of it. That's all. Thanks for listening. Check out the show notes on the website, coachingvb.com, for links and further information about this episode. You'll also be able to find the complete back catalog of prior coaching conversations. While you're there, you can sign up for my mailing list. Members find out in advance what conversations I'll be doing next and can submit questions if they like. If you'd like to support this podcast, go to patreon.com/coachingvb. Patrons get early access to every episode, as well as other special benefits along the way. I'm always interested in hearing what you think about coaching conversations and ideas you might have of topics and or guests for future episodes. You can send them to me at john@coachingvb.com, tweet them to @coachingvb, or hit me up on my Facebook page, Coaching Volleyball. All the best until next time.